You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 23rd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, global military spending is at an all-time high. We'll analyse the findings of a new report. Then the Turkish leader receives a ceremonial welcome in Iraq. We'll examine how Baghdad and Ankara can help each other. US troops are being expelled from Niger as the security pact with Washington breaks down. The unrest in the Sahel and the situation in Benin will likely come under the spotlight at the African Counter-Terrorism Summit. We'll look at the probable diplomatic pivot in the Maldives as a new government with a pro-China stance sweeps to power. We'll have a roundup of art stories and a flick through the papers, and then
I would definitely say it was the centre around the sort of more critical driven, intellectually driven art scene. And they had a restaurant, a bar, people were proclaiming, performing.
We'll take a stroll through an arty neighbourhood in Zurich. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The US is drafting sanctions that threaten to cut some Chinese banks off from the global financial system, which officials hope will stop Beijing's commercial support of Russia's military production. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's latest efforts to send some migrants to Rwanda finally won approval from Parliament in the early hours of this morning, clearing the way for the bill to become law. And on the first day of former US President Donald Trump's trial in New York yesterday, prosecutors said he broke the law and corrupted the 2016 election by trying to cover up sexual encounters with a porn star and a Playboy model, while his defence lawyer said he committed no crime. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, global defence spending has reached an all-time high. That's according to a new report issued by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI. Total global military expenditure reached $2,443 billion in 2023. That's an increase of 6.8% in real terms from the previous year. This was the steepest year-on-year increase since 2009 and the first time government military spending increased in all five geographical regions. Well, I'm joined now by Paul Rogers, Open Democracy's international security expert. Paul, it's lovely to have you back. Why is this spending increase happening?
It's multiple reasons. Partly it's because of the wars in Ukraine, and now we're going to see the impact of the war in Gaza. It's tensions in the South China Sea, the issue of China versus Taiwan. And overall, I think massive increases in spending in a number of countries. If you look at it overall, the dominant country in defence spending terms or military spending terms is the United States. That has about a third of all the world's spending. NATO as a whole is essentially well over half. About 53% of all world military spending is by the NATO group. And incidentally, it spends about 12 times as much as Russia. So in terms of the kind of league tables, the United States first, China quite a long way behind, then a cluster of countries, India, Germany, Russia, and the UK, all around sort of 75 to 80 billion a year, and then France and a number of others coming up. But the dominant ones are really those ones there. And what you're seeing, I think, is for different reasons, big increases in defence spending. One has to remember that in any of these countries, you have what are known as military-industrial complexes. You have very large companies with considerable, essentially, buying power, if you like, lobbying power. And it is also a situation that military spending, particularly when you get to arms sales, overseas arms sales, is frankly notoriously corrupt. So it's multiple reasons, but overall, the world is leading in a military direction. And of course, this is precisely at the time when many people are arguing that this is nonsense, that the biggest threat facing all of us, of course, is climate breakdown. Mm. But we're not getting any leverage on that yet, I'm afraid.
I wonder what percentage of this spending is for internal defence and how much of it goes in military aid to other countries?
Not that much in military aid, in terms of straight military aid. Obviously, you're probably talking about many billions of dollars even so. But essentially, it's on the individual spending. A lot of it, of course, is in alliances, and different countries will have different priorities. You also find that in the individual countries, there are inevitably many big monopolies. I mean, in a country like Britain, you only get one company that's producing submarines. It's the same in France. You may get two in the case of the United States. But broadly, any major item of expenditure, you might get it dominated by one company. And that means that you get a risk, and this is right across the world, not necessarily just in the West, of basically profligate spending. Mm. So there's a huge number of inefficiencies in the whole military process.
How has the war in Ukraine changed the way that European countries spend on defence?
Well, obviously, the increase in countries pretty close to Ukraine who want to protect themselves better. It's also the case that for European countries, you get more expenditure on aid to Ukraine. And that, of course, is one area where what you were just saying is not strictly true, because in the case of Ukraine and Israel, very large quantities of money are coming, at least temporarily, from other countries. You saw the huge thing that went through Congress recently. I think it's the best part of $85 billion essentially agreed for Ukraine and Gaza. So that is a bit of an exception to normal rule. But essentially, Ukraine is a major developer of, if you like, sort of instigator of increased spending, inevitably because of the assault by Russia. Mm. There's one other thing which I think is important, and that is in many countries, you actually get new developments following new developments, so to speak. So there's a huge concern at present with anti-drone technology, because relatively cheap drones have come to the fore in Gaza, but particularly in Ukraine, which are having a very big impact on the contact of wars. And that means there's a whole new area of research and development opening up for new weapons.
What's the picture like in Africa?
In Africa, well, I mean, you've got an item later in the programme which illustrates that. You have huge problems of wars. I mean, Sudan and particularly DRC have been devastating in human terms. And let's be absolutely clear about that. In terms of military spending, it varies a lot. But obviously, right across the Sahel, you're getting the development of the increased numbers of radical Islamist paramilitary groups, and that is causing many problems. And countries obviously are going to then put more defense money in to try and counter that. Overall, Africa is not the big spending continent by far. It is very much a sort of North America and Europe, and of course now Central and Eastern Asia, right across the Asian landmass. Mm. So relatively speaking, Latin America and Africa are relatively small banks, but that doesn't in any way diminish the capacity of the wars. As I say, DRC and Sudan, let alone Somalia, have been pretty devastating and continue to be. Overall, it's true to say that we're in an era of general defence spending rising through multiple reasons. And you could say, you know, years ago it was the Cold War, but now it's multiple reasons at a time when, as I say, many people are arguing that we're going up, barking up the wrong street in terms of the major threats.
Mm. I wonder how far military spending is reactive. I mean, is there a knock-on effect? If one state increases, do the neighbours usually follow suit?
Yes, this is what is known in the trade as a security dilemma. In order to be secure, you have to be stronger than your neighbour. Your neighbour feels insecure, therefore has to be stronger than you. And that is it's an issue which is there. It's a driving force. And again, very difficult to counter, because in any one state where you might get people saying our priorities are wrong, then obviously when it comes to military spending, they are basically regarded as sort of pacifists or anti-military or even sort of anti-government. And so it's difficult to get a debate on this. And there's a small but increasing number of specialists who argue that we really had to rethink what security is about. that with all this huge spending on the military, we're missing a trick in terms of what the major human needs really are. But I'd say that's a very early stage of the debate, and we've got a long, long way to go on that.
Now, not all of this is down to international conflict. How does the scenario differ, particularly in Central America and in the Caribbean?
In Central America and the Caribbean, you do get the historic problems, but most of the problems are internal. Across much of the Caribbean, but particularly the Central America, I would say, then an awful lot of it is down to the sort of dividing line between military and criminality, particularly with the way in which the drugs trade is so significant. It really is the marker for insecurity and also higher military spending in terms of countering the drugs trade. It's incredibly significant. And of course, it means once again, there's an awful lot of money around to buy people and buy interests. So Latin America, particularly Central America, has a particular problem. Across the Caribbean, it varies widely. You get some countries which really have terrible problems. Haiti is the obvious one. Others are peripheral to the drugs trade, but that really is primarily in Central America.
And Paul, finally, what are the risks of states prioritising military strength?
I think it's a risk right across the world, and we're seeing that even more. Now, you would say that because basically the area that I work in is like Cypriots on the peace side. But the reality is this is extraordinarily difficult to actually counter this. I mean, in the post 9/11 wars, we've seen, 900,000 people killed, another 4 million killed indirectly, 40 million people displaced, and trillions of dollars spent on the conflict. And we're still in a state of all kinds of problems in many of the countries from Afghanistan right through to Iraq. So somewhere things aren't working, but it's very difficult to argue against it.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. That's Paul Rogers there, and this is The Globalist. Twelve minutes past 9 in Baghdad, 7:12 here in London. Yesterday, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish president, arrived in Iraq for his first official visit in 11 years. Ankara wants more cooperation from Baghdad in its fight against a Kurdish militant group, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, that has a presence in northern Iraq. The two countries are also keen to find a solution to the issues of water supply and the exports of oil and gas, which has been halted for more than a year. I'm joined now by Monocle's Istanbul correspondent Hannah Lucinda Smith. Welcome back. Hannah, the Kurdish population is estimated to be between 30 and 45 million, but they don't comprise a majority in any country, and they are essentially a stateless people. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the history and why Turkey wants them eradicated.
Yeah, I mean, what Turkey would say is, you know, the fight that they're doing is not against the Kurdish people. They always say it's against the PKK, which is an armed group. It's been fighting in Turkey since the early 1980s. It's also got bases in northern Iraq. It's also got a presence since the start of the Syrian war in Syria. And its main target is the Turkish state, particularly Turkish police officers, Turkish state institutions. Turkey not only fights against this group on its own soil, it also takes the fight to Syria and also to Iraq. For a number of years, it's been launching pretty constant operations on Iraqi soil without the blessing of the government in Baghdad. This has been a real point of contention for more than a decade now. At times, Turkey has cooperated with, ironically, the Kurdish regional government, which is the Kurdish majority part of Iraq, also unhappy about having the PKK having bases on its soil. But yeah, for a long time, Turkey's really, really been, fighting hard diplomatically, also behind the scenes, trying to reach some kind of agreement with Baghdad to jointly cooperate on operations against the PKK.
So what is the PKK's relationship with the Iraqi authorities, and has there been any shift in that?
I mean, certainly, Baghdad has never been happy about having the PKK operating within Iraq's borders. Yeah, it's the same as any other state would say. You know, it's not something that it wants. at the same time, you know, it doesn't want Turkey, you know, unilaterally carrying out these kind of operations on its soil. It's not about supporting the PKK. It's about, you know, its own sovereignty. So I think there are benefits for both countries of, you know, working together. But there have been other things standing in the way of that relationship, principally water, as you mentioned, not just Iraq, but other countries across the region, countries like Syria, also Iran, have accused Turkey repeatedly of using water as a kind of diplomatic weapon. The main rivers in the region, the Euphrates and the Tigris, they both start from Turkey. Turkey has dammed those rivers in several places and really controls the water supply to, particularly to Iraq, which has been experiencing a massive drought over recent years. It's really become one of the main problems for Iraq. So this has been the kind of the leverage that Turkey has been able to use in these negotiations.
How would you characterise the relationship then between Iraq and Turkey? And is Erdogan attempting a reset?
Yeah, I mean, it's never been an easy one. You know, neighbourly relations in the Middle East are never easy between anyone. But, you know, particularly for the reasons we've mentioned, the water and also the fight against PKK with Iraq, it's been particularly testy. But I think this does look forward to a reset, as well as talking about security and about water issues. Also, Erdogan and Abdel Latif Rashid, the Iraqi president, were talking about business deals as well. Iraq is planning to build a huge road going right from the south, the ports in the Gulf, right to the north, to the Turkish border. Turkey's signed a memorandum to get involved with that. They're also looking at deals to supply Turkey with energy, other import-export deals. So I think, you know, this is being talked about in the Turkish press as a turning point in relations after a really long period where relations were very, very difficult.
And how much of this is to do with Turkey's domestic politics? Or is Erdogan wanting to establish himself as a leader amongst Islamic nations?
Yeah, I mean, I think Erdogan for a really long time has sort of thought of himself not just as a Turkish leader, but also as a kind of global leader of Muslims. That really took a bit of a knock over the past few years. The high point of that possibility for him was the start of the Arab Spring, when it looked like, you know, people, governments of his own mindset were coming to power. That sort of went into reverse after the coup in Egypt in 2013. But I think he still does, you know, want this role for himself as a Muslim figurehead, let's say, and certainly as a powerful leader in the region. He's always argued that, and his foreign ministers have always argued that Turkey should be looking not just to the West for its international relations, but also to its immediate region and to the region that used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. The former foreign minister and prime minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, called this strategic depth. It was the idea that, you know, Turkey naturally has this kind of soft power in its region and really should do more with that. But, you know, politics always gets in the way, right? Even though these are all Muslim countries, and in the case of some Sunni Muslim countries, the same as Erdogan, you know, other things do get in the way, and particularly rows over things like Erdogan's support for the Muslim Brotherhood and other regional groups have not made it easy for him.
Iraq is also resuming attacks on US forces in Syria. How would that affect Turkey, and will that be discussed?
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, I think this falls into the sort of wider issue of security. Turkey as well, not directly attacking US bases, but certainly hasn't been shy of, you know, putting American troops in the crossfire in Syria when it's been launching its own operations against the PKK offshoots there. So I think Turkey, you know, has a huge amount of support and sympathy, I think, for any governments that are looking to protect their own interests on their own soil. Also, of course, the issue of Gaza has again pitted Erdogan against particularly Israel, but also by extension the US. He's been making some extremely hard comments against those countries, and I think that's another area where the two countries, where Iraq and Turkey, are going to be in agreement.
Now, Erdogan said that Turkey has plans to launch a major operation against the PKK in the summer, aiming to permanently eradicate the threat. Is that possible, and what form will it take? What should we expect?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been sort of constant operations. It's an operation called Operation Claw. It's been going on for a couple of years in Iraq, but really sort of low level. And yeah, as Erdogan has said they're looking to up that this spring and fully eradicate. Now, whether or not you can fully eradicate a group that's been around now for four decades, really, really adept at hiding out in this kind of mountainous terrain that you find in northern Iraq and in southeastern Turkey, along the borders of Turkey, Iraq and Syria. These are the places where the PKK have been hiding out for decades, and they really know their way around that area. What tends to happen in Turkey is, and what happened in the past 10 years, is that Turkey will launch operations on Turkish soil, really going very, very hard, quite effectively drive the PKK out of bases in Turkey. But then what they do is they sort of melt away across the border and reestablish themselves in Iraq. So that's what Turkey hopes to do. How achievable that really is to totally eradicate. Has a group ever been totally eradicated? But I think certainly in terms of, domestic politics, it's something that plays really, really well with Turkish people. You know, as in any country, Turkish people get very, very angry when they see groups that they feel are harboured or perhaps supported by other countries launching attacks that kill Turks. So I think it is something that will play well, whatever the outcome.
Hannah Lucinda Smith in Istanbul, thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme.
I think the essence of it was maybe not to have rules or to kind of really be... Don't forget, it was the beginning of kind of surrealism, if you want so. So it was really about putting also a surrealist, a strange spin to strange and difficult times, to everything, and interrupt.
This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is Paul Waldie, who's Europe correspondent at the Globe and Mail. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning.
It's lovely to have you back. I expect you had a late night along with most British parliamentarians, because, of course, this Rwanda bill went through in the early hours of this morning. It became so much bigger than the sum of its parts. Talk us through.
Oh, it's taken months. I think 4 months to get this bill through Parliament. And the battle really isn't over, because now, of course, it could end up in the courts. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of legal challenges to this, as there were before when the previous version of this bill was introduced. This, of course, is Rishi Sunak's flagship effort to have some asylum seekers sent to Rwanda rather than have their cases adjudicated here in the UK. It's highly controversial. There's a lot of questions about whether this could violate international law, whether the European Court of Human Rights is going to step in again and try and stop it. It's already been blocked once by the Supreme Court here, who said that Rwanda could not be considered a safe place. The government's now reintroduced the legislation, effectively declaring that, in their view, Rwanda is a safe place to do this. They've given money to Rwanda, signed a treaty with Rwanda. So it's a huge effort by Rishi Sunak to try and stop these small boats from coming over from Calais. But, I think it's going to face more obstacles. He's hoping to get some flights off the ground in the summer, in July, but that remains up in the air effectively as well. So, I think this still has a long way to go before it's going to see the light of day.
And of course, it was a big marker in the relationship between the House of Lords, who are unelected, and the House of Commons. The House of Lords in the end kind of walking away and saying, okay, well, we acknowledge the primacy of the elected body. But I think that's very sad, in that the House of Lords is really the body where bills are actually scrutinised. Ian Dunn's excellent book, How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't, tells us about that is actually where all these things are read through. And clearly it was very much interrogated at that stage.
It was. The House of Lords was going to lose in the end, obviously. I think even they conceded that, because they're not elected, so therefore they have to defer to the elected House of Commons. And that's certainly what Rishi Sunak has been saying all along, that this really is a matter that the House of Commons has to decide, not the House of Lords. So the House of Lords went beyond its normal role of just scrutinizing legislation. They were actually proposing a number of amendments, And as the bill kept getting passed back and forth, they resisted efforts to just stop this process and just let the House of Commons have its way. Finally, last night, after a very long evening, they did relent and they said, okay, we give up, you win. But yeah, it was a long process and it could have gone on a lot longer. There are no real rules surrounding this, how many times this thing can go back and forth. But they did relent. It is back in the House of Commons. It did pass and now heads to the King for royal assent, which is expected pretty soon. So this thing will take effect this week or very soon. And then they've got to try and implement it. And that's where the real problems begin.
And of course, this is all coming in light of a forthcoming election.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, this, again, is something where Rishi Sunak is hoping to differentiate himself from the Labour Party, which is miles ahead in the polls. So he's looking for any way of trying to show that he's in charge and that the Conservatives have a real plan when it comes to this kind of stopping these small boats. The Labour Party argues this is a horrendously expensive effort, this horrendously expensive program that probably won't work and doesn't address the bigger problem, which is all kind of other refugee claims that are facing the government and that aren't being dealt with. They're saying this program, this Rwanda program, is going to cost something like £2 million per person that they send, whereas there's a backlog of 50, 60, even 100,000 cases that aren't being dealt with. So they want to get through that backlog before they address this kind of thing. Sunak is saying, no, we've got to stop this immediately. So it's going to be an election issue. But of course, Sunak's got to get this program going before he can really claim any kind of victory here.
Absolutely. Let's go to the US now and see what's happening in campuses, college campuses across the country. The New York Times has a very good report about these pro-Palestinian protests.
Yeah, I mean, we've had protests on college campuses really since October 7th when, Hamas fighters attacked Israel and killing 1,200 people and taking 200 plus hostages. And Israel's, of course, retaliated with quite a strong military action in Gaza, which, of course, is Hamas is saying has killed about 30,000 people. So university campuses have been protesting for quite a while. Most of these protests tend to be pro-Palestinian protests. They really escalated last week when the president of Columbia University called in the police to arrest protesters who had set up encampments around the campus. So about 100 students were arrested. Some faculty members were arrested as well. That has set off a wave of protests across the U.S. And now we're seeing similar types of camps erected in Yale, New York University, and at Yale yesterday, about 60 protesters were arrested. New York University police arrested a bunch of people there as well. Harvard's closed down the Harvard Square because they don't want any kind of camps being set up there. Columbia has now gone even further and canceled classes and basically shifted everything to online because they're so worried about further protests in California. So it's really kind of building because of this action that Columbia took. Now, where this ends, nobody really knows because more students are saying they're going to set up these types of camps and more sympathetic organizations are setting up camps as well. So it's becoming quite a problem for the college administrators, for student groups, and now for the police.
The New York Times is reporting that there was a break for Seder for the beginning of Passover last night.
There was, and I mean, I think there's a lot of sympathy for how Jewish students are reacting to this, and that was the case at Columbia. One of the reasons the university president took her action was because Jewish groups were saying, look, you know, we're feeling really afraid to go to campus. We're feeling afraid just to get through the gates of the campus and make our way in and out of classes. So she took that action. The arrests happened again Monday. There has been a bit of a break, I think, on some of the campuses because Passover has begun. However, you know, it's probably going to start up again once that's over and once we get back to sort of regular classes later this week.
Let's stay in the U.S. and look at Joe Biden's re-election prospects and how they're being influenced by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the well-known conspiracist.
Anti-vaxxer, yeah. I mean, for the longest time, pundits have kind of been saying, you know, in a head-to-head matchup, Trump is a little bit ahead of Biden, but when you throw in third-party candidates, that's really going to hurt Biden. There's always been this expectation, especially Robert F. Kennedy, because he ran initially against Biden for the Democratic nomination, was a long-shot bid. Now he's shifted, and he's going to run as an independent in the election in November, and there's always been this suggestion, well, that's going to hurt Biden because all these votes, all these anti-Biden votes, people who don't like Trump, they're going to go vote for Robert F. Kennedy. But polling's starting to show that that's not the case, that in fact, Biden benefits from a Kennedy candidacy because he's drawing more votes from Trump supporters. And some of these polls are showing that where Trump had a lead of maybe 1% or 2%, Biden takes the lead when you factor in Kennedy into the questioning. In other words, just get away from a straight head-to-head matchup when voters are asked, what about, would you vote for Kennedy? More Trump voters say, yes, they're willing to do that than Biden voters. So in fact, Biden may actually want Kennedy's campaign to be stronger than a lot of people thought might have been the case a few months ago, because he actually could do better, because Kennedy kind of has the same anti-vax kind of conspiracy theory stuff that a lot of Trump voters share. So he tends to draw more from them than he does from Biden.
I mean, there was a piece in The Guardian a few days ago, saying that that Kennedy said that Trump had asked him to be his running mate.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, so there's obviously some connection. There's some sympathy there. And I think even there's been reports that some Kennedy staffers have said quietly that their whole ambition is to make sure Biden doesn't win. Therefore, they're hoping that their candidacy helps Trump. But in fact, they may be shooting themselves in the foot here if that's the case, because their candidacy may in fact help Biden, because so many Trump voters are more interested in Kennedy than Biden voters.
Mm. Now, the eclipse, you'd think that coverage about it was over. But what's the one thing that everybody's told when an eclipse happens?
Exactly. Well, we're always told, don't look at the sun. And especially during an eclipse that lasts for 3 hours, don't look at it. You know, don't stare at the sun. Well, what's happened now is that Quebec's health ministry for the first time has started collecting data about reports of eye problems people have been suffering because of the eclipse. They've so far come across 28 cases, which doesn't sound like a lot, but what they're saying is, we think there's a lot more out there, because people don't necessarily report or go to an optometrist when they feel some discomfort in their eyes because of the eclipse. But they're saying some of these cases could be quite serious, because you don't really know when you're staring at the sun the damage it could be causing to your eye, because it's painless. And what optometrists are saying is it can be quite severe. If you look quite quickly at the sun, it doesn't really matter. But if it's several times over the course of 3 hours, which was happening during this eclipse, it can cause really some damage. It can maybe just cause some discomfort, maybe some inflammation, but there's a chance you could be doing some real damage to your retina. And that's what the health ministry in Quebec is trying to establish. How far did these cases progress? How serious was this? And it's interesting, I think, that they're actually collecting data on this, because there'll be another eclipse in X years, and it may or may not pass over as many populated areas as this last one did, which is why it got so much attention. But it's still interesting that people might have thought they were okay looking at an eclipse, because the sun is obviously covered by the moon, but not the case if you do it long enough or enough times.
There really is no excuse. That information is everywhere.
And it was on that day, right? Don't do it, or use better sunglasses or something. But I guess it was just because it lasted so long, right? And people thought they could look away. But that's actually what you're not supposed to do.
Paul Waldy, thank you very much indeed. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The US is drafting sanctions that threaten to cut some Chinese banks off from the global financial system, which officials hope will stop Beijing's commercial support of Russia's military production, according to the Wall Street Journal. As Secretary of State Antony Blinken visits China this week, the question is whether this potent financial threat can dent the China-Russia trade, enabling Moscow to rebuild its military after losses in Ukraine. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's latest effort to send some migrants to Rwanda finally won approval from Parliament in the early hours of this morning, when the unelected House of Lords recognised the primacy of the elected House of Commons and dropped the last of its proposed amendments, clearing the way for the bill to become law. Sunak has staked his political future to the deportation flights, making a pledge to stop what he calls illegal migration a key part of his pitch to voters, as opinion polls show that his Conservative Party trails far behind the Labour Party ahead of a general election later this year. And on the first day of former US President Donald Trump's trial in New York yesterday, prosecutors said he broke the law and corrupted the 2016 election by trying to cover up sexual encounters with a porn star and a Playboy model, while his defense lawyer said he committed no crime. The case is seen by many legal experts as the least consequential of the Trump prosecutions. The guilty verdict would not bar him from taking office, but it could hurt his candidacy, with polls showing 1 in 4 Republicans say they would not vote for him if he's convicted. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. In July last year, the democratically elected president of Niger, Mohamed Bazoum, was overthrown in a coup. The West African country's military junta expelled French troops, and now the US military is set to follow them out. For 12 years, Washington had a security pact that allowed American forces to be stationed in Niger to help fight jihadist terrorism. But after talks this week between the US Deputy Secretary of State and Niger's Prime Minister, it appears the agreement cannot be salvaged, and around 1,000 American military personnel will leave the country. Tara O'Connor is the founder and executive director of Africa Risk Consulting, a pan-African consulting company, and she joins me down the line now. Tara, why has this security pact failed?
Well, I think the main reason was actually the military coup. So the military coup was really about the military that was facing corruption charges under the new regime actually took the opportunity to take power and then look for new partners to protect themselves and turn to Russia. And Russia had already established relationships with Mali, the next door country, and since then has built up what they call the Alliance of Sahelian States, three countries that are bound together within the sphere of influence of Russia, Russia's sphere of influence.
So, I mean, this withdrawal of US troops could be considered a very large strategic victory for Russia.
Absolutely. And it was posted on Telegram that this was an objective of Russia's objective in the also in the wider context, the wider geopolitical context. We have to note that really Russia has been at war with the West since 2014, stepped it up with the invasion of Ukraine in 2020. And the second front is really a battle for control of the Sahel. Mm. So this is quite a considerable success for them.
How much of an impact will the withdrawal of the troops have on security in the region and the US's stated aim of defeating jihadi terrorism?
Well, we have to note that the withdrawal in France the withdrawal of French troops from Mali and from Burkina Faso, the actual uptick in insurgency has been considerable. In Niger, the 1,000-strong US troop and drone force managed to keep insurgency attacks in Niger to a very minimum compared to all three countries. So I think in the short term, what we can expect is that jihadist groups will see this as open season as they have seen in neighbouring countries. But it remains to be seen how effective the Russian military presence will be in the country, in the counterinsurgency activity over the year ahead.
Mm. Of course, the continent is coming together to try and counter this. The Africa Counterterrorism Conference began yesterday in Nigeria. And I wonder what's going to be discussed there.
Well, I think the real fear of the region is that this spreads, that the insurgency spreads, that the uncertainty created by this transition of allegiance away from the West to Russia and what the gap will leave. We've already seen incursions in Mauritania, incursions in Benin. And so you've actually had this counterterrorism summit in Abuja, led by Bola Tinubu, president of Nigeria. And the idea is to look at cooperation. What's interesting is that the Alliance of Sahelian States are not present.
Mm, mm. You mentioned Benin. There was a terrorist attack there last week, and that's just the latest in a string of attacks. What's driving the violence, particularly in Benin?
So really, for the insurgency groups, these are raid and retreat organizations. They feed off the ground that they are operating in. And really, the Sahel is extremely poor, one of the poorest regions of the continent. And Benin, Ghana, and the neighboring countries to these Sahelian countries are a lot wealthier. So the raid and retreat attraction is as much keeping going from these insurgency groups.
Mm. The conference in Nigeria, it says it aims to enhance multilateral counterterrorism cooperation. It also wants to reshape the international community's collective response to terrorism in Africa. But with the expulsion of France and the US from Niger and many other countries coming under Russian influence, what might that international response look like?
Well, I think one of the significant changes is that the European Union, France are very strongly behind the new mantra, which is African solutions to African problems, and that the France and Western support will only follow the lead of recognized African West African institutions such as the ECOWAS, the African Union, not necessarily any calls for help from the AES countries. And so it really, what happens here will determine the extent of the West's involvement, of, say, France and the European Union's renewed engagement. And that's what we're looking at, is kind of what will the renewed international engagement in the region be?
Tara, thank you very much indeed. That's Tara O'Connor there. And this is Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 11:40 in Male and 8:40 in Zurich. In the Maldives, a landslide victory following a record turnout for Sunday's parliamentary election has confirmed the country's pivot to a China-centric view. The president, Mohamed Mouzou's People's National Congress Party, has claimed a super majority, taking control away from the pro-India Maldivian Democratic Party. We're here to explain it to us is Robin Brandt, who is the BBC's former China correspondent. Good morning to you.
Morning to you.
Robin, I wonder if you can give us a snapshot of the political situation in the Maldives just pre this election.
Well, look, what we're seeing is not a sudden shift from a nation, a government, a people who have suddenly decided they don't see their future in Delhi, but see their future in Beijing. This has been a long-term shift in terms of allegiance, a financial reliance, and a burgeoning strategic partnership as well between the people of the Maldives and its government and China. And what we have with this landslide election victory, and the majority is vast, is an affirmation, a very clear affirmation, that in terms of financial support, maybe even military support further down the line, the Maldives government sees its strategic future with Beijing. And I think the key word there is strategic. Look at where the Maldives is, sitting bang smack in the middle of the Indian Ocean. That is something that China's government, its Communist Party, its military finds very appealing on very many levels.
Mm. What do you think increased Chinese influence in the archipelago, particularly if there is a military presence, means for India, which of course is geographically close to the Maldives?
It adds to anxiety that already exists in the Indian government and the Indian military that sees a growing Chinese presence, a physical presence. I mean, we had maritime port calls in just the past few weeks by Chinese vessels in the Maldives. And I think as well, it would look to what else is going on around the region. In Sri Lanka, well-documented cases there of vast Chinese financial support and investment, huge debts owed by the Sri Lankan government to the Chinese government. And in the end, that resulted in what's known as a debt for equity swap, where the Beijing government essentially took on a long-term lease of a port in Sri Lanka. And there would be a worry among some in India and beyond, critics in the Maldives as well, that this is a foothold that could well see Chinese kind of commercial maritime presence, but also military presence, establishing a much more semi-permanent footing in the Maldives. Look to Djibouti as well, further away, but that is an area where the Chinese revealed over the last few years they were establishing some kind of maritime presence, which in the end is a de facto maritime base. So those two examples give you a good idea of the context in which some in India would see this development in the Maldives after the back of a parliamentary election as just adding to increasing concern about Chinese influence, financial, commercial, maybe even military, but also a physical Chinese presence, maybe.
Mm. We know that the Maldives is one of the countries most vulnerable to sea level rises caused by the climate crisis. I wonder what the new government's environmental policy is and if they can expect support from China with that.
They will expect support across the spectrum from the Chinese government, from Chinese financial institutions. I mean, look, China brings great expertise in terms of construction, in terms of trying to tackle the impact of climate change in our world. And the government of the Maldives will be looking to China for that. The question is, though, is what are the other obligations, the other commitments that come with it? I mentioned Sri Lanka a little earlier. That resulted in that debt for equity swap and vast sums of debt owed by the Sri Lankan government to the Chinese. You know, the Maldives is already in the pocket for a substantial amount of money to the Chinese government off the back of, you know, decades-long diplomatic and commercial relationships. So the question will be, even if the Maldives were turned to China for a range of support, a range of expertise in dealing with one of this most pressing and existential issues, the problem will be, as many will say, was what are the other obligations that come with it? I mean, there is vast financial pressures when you have that kind of debt owed from a tiny country to a behemoth like China and its financial institutions.
Robin, thank you very much indeed. That's Robin Brandt there. That was the BBC's former China correspondent. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Now it's time to talk arts and culture with the arts journalist Amma Rose Abrams, who joins us down the line now. Amma, you are or have been at the Venice Biennale. Tell us all about it.
Well, it's a busy week. but yes, the Venice Biennale previewed last week and opened officially on Saturday. It was a frenetic event. It was busy. There were a huge amount of collateral shows. These exhibitions are open around Venice during the Biennale. And the central show, the pavilions and the main exhibition, which are kind of like the centre of it all, were really impressive this year, actually.
What in particular stood out for you?
What stood out for me? I mean, I think there was the winning pavilion, the pavilion that won the Golden Lion, which was by artist Archie Moore, First Nations artist, who presented Kith and Kin, where he traced his family tree back 65,000 years. And
he's Australian, we should say. Yeah.
Yes, he's Australian. And he was, I guess, highlighting, you know, the differences in, you know, our calendars, traditions, all of these things, and the history there of the Aboriginal people. And so that was really, really wonderful work. And I think it touched a lot of people. And Australia has never won a Golden Lion before. So I think that was great for them. Really, really exciting.
And interesting, the medium in which he works, it's chalk.
Yes. Yes. And so you can't, so it's like, again, there was another theme at the Biennale, a bit about kind of openness, impermanence, and a bit of a reaction against traditional, like, here's a big sculpture, it's going to be here forever. And I think his work kind of speaks to that. But yes, he drew on the walls of the kind of the pavilion in chalk, so you could kind of walk around, cast your eye up and down, kind of to be taken around these different names, information, things like that, with a kind of central sculpture that hung from the ceiling in the middle.
Mm. So tell us more about some of the best pavilions. What was the UK like, or perhaps Egypt?
Egypt was fantastic. Everyone was so excited about Egypt. This is artist Wael Shawkey, and he works, he doesn't produce that frequently because he makes these long films and they're very complicated, incredibly well researched about different points in history, mainly focusing on the Middle East, but not always. And then he often works with marionettes, but this time he staged and filmed in Alexandria a full-scale opera about an uprising, a revolutionary uprising in 1882, and the film's called Drama 1882, and it just basically stages the events and but it's stunning, amazing music, beautiful costumes, very informative. The research was unbelievable, and it just really had enormous queues every single day. People just were desperate to see it.
And some of the others, I'm hearing that Nigeria and Ethiopia were particularly good, as was Bulgaria.
Yes, exactly. Nigeria was amazing. Nigeria Imaginary. It was a group show, and it had some very stunning artists in it. Yinka Shonabare, Toyin Ogio Dutola, and Precious Okeyomon, very famous contemporary artists, alongside some less known artists. And it just was stunning. It looked great. The art was amazing. And the kind of, it brought together known artists with less known artists on the international scale. It was, you know, it's another one that everyone was talking about. Bulgaria was amazing. It was a kind of, it's kind of built out of a long, long period, another one of long, long period of a historical research. It was called The Neighbours, and it was it recreated survivors' homes that had been victims of the political violence during the communist era, and told their stories. And when you hear it, you think, OK, that sounds like something I've seen before, but it was so detailed, well done. The sculptural side of it, so the stages of the homes, were so kind of tenderly and so kind of interestingly put together, and you just kind of wandered through these empty homes whilst listening to these accounts, and it was very beautiful and very moving. And Ethiopia was unusual in a way because it was painting, and it's Tesfaye Oghessa, and he's been quite a kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say he was a celebrity, but on the art scene, he's very well known. Everyone absolutely loves him. And but it was curated by the author Len Sisse. And it was they're just beautiful, quite gestural paintings. And it's like groups of people painted together. And you might be kind of slightly evocative of cubism for people. The bodies are slightly twisted. Everything's a little bit to one side, a little bit uncanny. But they're incredibly, incredibly beautiful paintings, and they were just staged in a very traditional way, unusual for the Biennale again, because often people try and do something like very striking. But this just was quite a traditional art show, but fantastic. And then the UK was John Acomfra, who I think people will know the name. And it was Listening All Night to the Rain was his staging. And it was a kind of, it was in a series of cantos, the filmic cantos. And you kind of walked through the pavilion, and it addressed a lot of the issues that he often addresses in his work.
Emma, thank you very much indeed. That's Emma Rose Abrams there. Now we head to Zurich. Not necessarily the first place to spring to mind when thinking about anti-establishment revolutionaries, but it's in the old town where you'll find the original Cabaret Voltaire, the birthplace of Dadaism. It's also where you'll find Zurich One, a collective of contemporary galleries giving their more famous neighbours in Basel a run for their money. Emma Nelson went for a walk with Fabian Lang, the founder of the Zurich One Group, and they began in an uncommonly noisy part of the old town.
It sounds more like a building site, but this is the beating heart of Zurich's art scene, isn't it?
Yes. Right now there is a lot of building going on here. They are ripping open the street to renew the pipes. Only for 7 years we're going to have this right in front of it.
And 7 years is a mere blink when it comes to this part of town and its relationship with art. Fabian Lang is Zurich-born and raised. He wanted to create something that would carry the city's rich artistic history forward, so he created Zurich One.
Zurich One is a kind of community of galleries in the old town, and some also on an international level. And there was a bit of a phenomenon going on 5 years ago when I came here. I realized galleries settle down here again, something I knew was the case before. I really wanted to be in that area too, because of its history, because of all the stories that have been going around here in this part. I thought I seek the opportunity and ask them if they want to kind of group up and make a joint effort in mobilizing people and coming to see art more, because Zurich audience sometimes has to be a bit kicked in the butt to go out of the house and go and see art. And I asked a couple of established galleries in the area if they want to think this is a good idea. And by now, from 5 galleries, we are now, 5 years later, 16 galleries in the area.
Tell us about the origins of this area artistically. I mean, you mentioned that it has a great history. What are the stories that happened here on the hill?
In the 1910s, it was really the beginning of art institutions in Zurich here, with the building of the Kunsthaus.
The Kunsthaus being the founding home of what would become a huge institution, now a giant building designed by David Chipperfield and home to world-class art. Then it was a home for the 24 or so members of the city's Artists' Society. Fabien continues.
But also a little bit later, Cabaret Voltaire, which was a vibrant, sceney place where really mad and driven artists who also wanted to change the system kind of met and founded the now very well-known Dadaist movement. All over the course of the 20th century, there are writers, not just galleries, but also in the Second World War, you would have people from the war escaping to Zurich, trying to find a safe haven here. And now it seems to be, that's what we wanted to do with Zurich One, grab this momentum of where people come here again and want to exhibit art, to kind of grab that momentum and remind people of the history of the place, but also revive it.
So with the starting point, his gallery, from the top of the old town, Fabien and I went for a little wander. Which way should we go?
We should go just straight and then left down here.
Is this an entirely international scene, or is this something that you want to get the Swiss a little bit more engaged with?
Zurich is much more international than most people think. It's become much more international over the last few years. The second language feels like being English here. A lot of expats. It's changed very much over the last 10 years since I left and came back.
Down cobbled slopes and past tiny hidden corners with the discreet signage that could only belong to the best of art. And then we hit the spot.
This is the Cabaret Voltaire, by the way.
In February 1916... gründete Hugo Ball in der Spiegelgasse 1 das Cabaret Voltaire, aus dem Dada entstand.
Tell us what happened here. I mean, there's a sign outside saying on the 5th of February 1916, Cabaret Voltaire opened and Dadaism was founded. And it's... there you are. I mean, this is where it all happened.
I would definitely say it was the centre around the sort of more critical-driven, intellectually-driven art scene. And they had a restaurant, a bar, people were proclaiming, performing, and also they met regularly, founding this group, Dadaism, putting down that pamphlet, I think what it's called, the kind of rules and regulation of Dadaism.
A bit of a leap of faith to learn that in what is one of the most genteel and well-behaved cities, that some of the most reactionary minds found their spiritual home. Espoused by the likes of Marcel Duchamp and Man Ray, Dadaism rejected reason, rationality and order, favouring chaos, nonsense and a strong anti-bourgeois sentiment.
It was very much about what happened in the First World War and them then bringing a less regulated, very free-spirited way to art and being extremely playful with it. I think the essence of it was maybe not to have rules or to kind of really be... Don't forget, it was the beginning of kind of surrealism, if you want so. So it was really about putting also a surrealist, a strange spin to strange and difficult times, to everything, and interrupt also.
And when you are doing work with Zurich One and you're walking past this, I don't know, every couple of days, and how does it make you feel that you are now part of the next generation of the Zurich art scene?
I just do my thing. We're doing a show. We're doing our shows. I put a lot of effort into our shows, into the context of our shows. But certainly I'm inspired by these movements. I studied it. I studied art history. I studied theatre. I wanted to be... it was definitely burning inside of me.
And with Fabien in the city and with Zurich One celebrating its 5th anniversary this year, there's much to be excited about. For Monocle in Zurich, I'm Emma Nelson.
That's all for today's programme. Thanks to Emma. Also to our producers, Laura Kramer, Tom Webb and Monocle Lillis. Our researcher, Gunnar Gronlid, and our studio manager, Steph Chungu, with editing assistance from Flynn Simmons. Headlines and more music on the way, and the briefing is live at midday London time. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow.